A major for-profit college shuts its doors and a crackdown on pay-to-play political contributions. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, September 6th. Thank you for joining us today. Although the presidential race gets all the headlines, let's just set aside the quality of those headlines for now, there are other politics out there. Congress is back in session, and it just wouldn't be Congress without the threat of a government shutdown. This time, because a toxic mix of presidential politics and budget realities has slowed that august body to even more of a crawl. Nancy Marshall Genzer tells us why.
If you thought there was a coherent budget process, think again. The government's fiscal year closes at the end of this month, so Congress has just a little more than 3 weeks to pass bills funding the entire federal government for the coming year. And really, that's not going to happen, says Stan Collender, budget guru and executive vice president of MSL Group.
Rationality is not what's driving activities in Washington. It's irrationality. It's people saying, you know, I'm going to take my ball and go home.
It's government gone wild. Then again, Collender says, at this point, there's only a 10-15% chance of a government shutdown because nobody wants to be blamed for it. And there's another deadline looming. We'll hit the debt ceiling this spring, maxing out our government credit card. Congress will have to vote to raise the debt limit.
It's a must-pass bill.
That's Steve Bell with the Bipartisan Policy Center. He says because it's a must-pass bill, members of Congress can load it up with other stuff they want.
You have to increase the debt limit at some point. And yes, you can put things on it.
Things other lawmakers may not like. Greg Daco is chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics. He says, really, though, Congress has almost no choice. It has to increase the debt limit. Otherwise, you get sharp cuts in government spending.
If you cut that suddenly, that's a major, major hit on the economy. And that would probably lead us into a recession.
Which would really make voters mad. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Let's talk about pay-to-play for a moment. It has come up recently. Goldman Sachs just laid down tough new internal rules about donating to political campaigns. The firm says partners cannot donate to state and local political candidates or to state and local officials who are running for federal office. That would include current Indiana governor and VP hopeful Mike Pence. So we thought we'd take a look at this idea of pay-to-play and why Goldman is being so careful about it. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that look.
The idea of pay-to-play is just what it sounds like.
Someone has to make a campaign contribution or get money into politics in order to be in the game, in order to expect to get any results.
Eric Heberlig is professor of political science at UNC Charlotte. This isn't just companies bribing politicians for government contracts. More often, it's the politicians demanding money from companies in order to be considered for a government contract.
And there's a long, unfortunate history of exactly this sort of arrangement.
Richard Skinner is a policy analyst with the Sunlight Foundation.
There have been scandals over the years. Some years ago, the controller of the state of New York was brought down by exactly this sort of scandal.
The SEC passed rules about this in 2010 that specifically targeted financial advisors. It basically flipped the incentives in pay-to-play by saying, if you do donate to a candidate, you can't get a government financial contract from that official for 2 years. Skinner says this is especially important at the state level.
Because there are so many big state pension funds.
Pension funds that banks would love to manage. That's why Goldman's rules target giving to state and local office holders.
So if you're Goldman Sachs and you want to be considered for this business, you might want to decide that your employees are not going to be making campaign contributions.
This does not mean, however, that financial companies can't be involved in politics. They are. It's more at the national level, where state pension business isn't an issue. Goldman Sachs PAC gave $1.8 million to candidates for the U.S. Congress so far in the 2016 election cycle. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Today, ITT Tech, that's the for-profit college that's been the center of government investigations and lawsuits for years now, announced that it is closing. The company blamed sanctions by the U.S. Department of Education, which cut off federal aid to new students. So effective today, ITT says it's cut most of its 8,000 employees. On top of that, about 40,000 students are scrambling to figure out what to do next. Gigi Duban reports.
The kiss of death for ITT Tech was when the government recently banned the for-profit school from enrolling new students with federal financial aid. Now that the school is closing, students could seek to cancel $500 million in federal loans.
So the amount of damage that this company appears to have done is very worrisome.
That's Stephen Bird, senior policy analyst at New America. He says ITT's closing was abrupt, way more sudden than for-profit Corinthian colleges closing for the same reasons last year.
So I'm sure that there are lots of students who have no idea what they're supposed to do at this point.
They have two options: keep paying their loans and transfer their credits somewhere else, but even ITT says it's unlikely other schools will take them, or have the loans wiped out through the government's closed school discharge. But Luke Herron, legal coordinator for the Debt Collective, which helps students get debt relief, says if Corinthian was any indication, the government isn't eager to do that.
In the past, department officials were literally on Corinthian campuses telling students to enroll in places like ITT Tech.
Trace Erden, managing director for Credit Suisse, says this probably won't end at ITT Tech.
My feeling is that over the next several years, we're going to see a lot more schools close.
That's because ITT and other for-profit schools depend on federal student aid for almost all of their revenue. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a new report came out on the health of American services. The data was described as, quote, shockingly weak. That and other depressing August information suggests no rate rise in September. That all sounds bad, but Wall Street liked it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It ain't sexy, but it is finally getting some attention. The one economic issue both presidential candidates support is infrastructure, and about time, too. Hillary Clinton wants to spend $275 billion. Donald Trump wants to double that. Now, we all know about the potholes and the crumbling bridges, the power outages. But economically, what is the best long-term investment, the biggest bang for the infrastructure buck? We asked Marketplace's Scott Tong to look into it.
Better roads, power lines, and water systems, they help us produce more things and more services for less money. They boost the economy, according to most studies. Economist Heidi Kribo-Redeker is the CEO of International Capital Strategies, a consultancy. And her rule of thumb is if you put in $1.3
billion... $1.3 billion gets you $2 billion in growth. The compelling case is that the dollar in on a macro basis results in more than a dollar out.
She says $1.3 billion also delivers you about 30,000 jobs in general. Now, the details really matter here because some bridges lead somewhere and some lead nowhere. So you'd think there'd be a handy national list of the best investments, the biggest benefits to the most people. Doesn't exist. See, Kribo-Redeker says the country's money, it doesn't flow from Washington.
About three quarters roundabout of our infrastructure is funded through the municipal bond market under the purview of state and local governments. And that's the way that we are structured.
It's hard to make national comparisons. But the good news is more decisions today are trying to be merit-based. You know, benefit-cost analysis, empirical, geeky. And it turns out the big new cross-country highway or rail projects, they don't deliver the most today. That nation-building stuff, we did it already, says Robert Puentes, CEO of the Eno Center for Transportation think tank.
We were connecting the country within. We were getting farmers unstuck from the mud. That was a long time ago. A lot of those big trends have played themselves out. The big challenge that we have is because all the stuff was built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, it's got to be rehabilitated. It's got to be maintained.
Maintenance. Consider, our power grid suffers more than 300 big outages every year. One in nine bridges is deficient, and every year brings 240,000 water main breaks. Puentes says $1 spent on upkeep, on preventing a billion-dollar catastrophe, is a great investment.
It's easier to allocate money for new shiny projects than for fixing things, but we do know that it's always cheaper and it's always better in the long run to maintain the existing system than wait until it has to have wholesale rehabilitation.
In his view, the way to prioritize is to ask, what are you trying to achieve? If you want to get more people to more jobs far away, you might buy more buses. If you want a next generation workforce, you might build new schools.
Are we trying to boost international competitiveness? well, that's going to lead you to projects around probably freight movement or ports. If we're trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then you would probably look at projects that are going to get people to choose something other than the single occupant vehicle, biking or walking or taking mass transit.
The challenge is when the ideal world crashes into the one we have. We're talking about the politics of infrastructure money. And there's a lot of political inertia in the system, says transportation consultant Alan Pisarski.
There's a tendency to keep spending the way you spend and giving 13% to this region. This region gets 9% instead of saying, what does the region as a region need?
And any numbers are open to opportunistic fudging. One of the old tricks is what he calls optimism bias. Propose to build something and then overestimate how many people are going to use it.
There's a tendency to be positive about, yes, this is really going to work, especially when you're using other people's money, strangely enough, that bias comes in.
But politics may not even be the biggest challenge when it comes to money and infrastructure. Pisarski worries about future assumptions, because the future is so fuzzy. Who's going to be living where? Downtown or no? Driving or no?
This is, to me, the most volatile and difficult period for forecasting travel activity, autonomous vehicles, Uber, auto ownership, walking, biking. The drama, if you will, is substantial.
Still, to him, the system is moving gradually, slowly, from the politicians to the big data quants. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Some of the nation's largest health insurers have ditched Obamacare exchanges recently, leaving consumers with fewer options. That matters because competition usually leads to better service. This morning, lawyers filed a complaint with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, alleging that 7 insurers in 8 states are discriminating against people with HIV or AIDS by charging them higher prices. From our health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
When you've got HIV, staying on top of your medicine is pretty much the most important thing you do every day.
We have to take these pills to stay alive.
John Dunham is a 32-year-old Uber driver living in Birmingham, Alabama. Last fall, he was shopping for insurance on the Obamacare exchange.
If I was to be on a Humana Silverland plan, my medicine would cost me $1,500 a month. A lot of people in Alabama cannot afford that. I am one of those people.
Instead, Dunham went with the Blue Cross Blue Shield plan. His drugs there only cost him $50 a month. So what's up with the big difference? Humana and Blue Cross price the same drugs very differently. Attorney Kevin Costello says insurers can't target the sick. To him, that difference proves some plans are doing just that, working very hard to keep people with HIV/AIDS away.
What the Affordable Care Act says is you are not allowed as an insurer to discourage enrollment for high-cost populations.
Costello works for the Center for Health Law at Harvard. The center filed complaints today against insurers in 8 states, including Humana, Cigna, and Anthem. Costello says keeping sick and expensive people out violates one of the main provisions of Obamacare, that people with pre-existing conditions shouldn't face discrimination. Houston, Texas-based Community Health Choice says it rejects the lawsuit premise and said its ACA plans must be reviewed and approved by federal health officials. No other insurer responded in time for this story. Stanford economist Maria Polyakova says financially, insurers must find the right mix of patients.
It is not surprising that they would try to attract healthier people and try to dissuade sicker people from enrolling in their plans.
Right now, insurers say they're bleeding money, and some big ones are leaving the exchanges. So this kind of so-called cherry-picking, says Polyakova, is just what happens in this system, making it hard to find policy solutions.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
Good morning. How are you? Good, good, good.
Dr. Karen Mausner is looking in on one of his patients at the LAX clinic in downtown Philadelphia. Mausner says many of his HIV/AIDS folks are stable, as long as they keep taking their meds. That success, he says, is now in jeopardy.
We're setting them up to fail. And when you fail HIV treatment, your rate of complications go up. You're diminishing their life expectancy. You can impact negatively their quality of life. and that's immoral.
Maunzer worries some insurers steering HIV patients away will force others to follow suit or risk taking a big hit. He worries this has the makings of a race to the bottom. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I'm a sailor, and the winds off Long Island are virtually always blowing.
So much so that they built the first offshore wind farm there. But first, let's do the numbers. A good day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 0.25%, 46 points. It closed at 18,538. The NASDAQ advanced 0.5%, 26 points to finish at 5275. And that is a record high, people. The S&P 500 ticked up 0.3%, 6 points to end the day at 2186. Now, having read the data tea leaves today, Wall Street seems to think the Federal Reserve isn't likely to raise interest rates soon. You know who didn't like that? Financial firms. Morgan Stanley gave up 0.4%, Citigroup shed nearly 0.5%, Wells Fargo gave back 0.1%, and Bank of America withdrew nearly 0.33%. Now, as for that NASDAQ record, Facebook did its part. Stocks in the social media giant clicked up 2.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.53%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Although it sometimes feels like the tech industry revolves around millennials or rich people who just don't want to shop for themselves or do their own laundry, the numbers suggest that the startup market with the most potential is a few generations senior. Jody Holtzman is the Senior Vice President of Market Innovation at AARP. Jody, welcome to the program.
Hi, Molly. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm so interested in this story because I've been a tech reporter for a long time, and I find that this is a hot target company for technology, and you've done this research. What makes baby boomers such a hot target market?
Well, several things, starting with the fact that they generate $7.6 trillion worth of economic activity out of, you know, a total GDP of the U.S. So baby boomers represent essentially the third largest market in the world after the U.S. and China, and over $3 trillion larger than Japan. And they spend over $5 trillion a year in consumer spending. So right there, an obvious market.
Well, and a market with specific needs, right? What kinds of needs do boomers have that can be fulfilled by tech and startups?
So I think that there are several categories. So the products and services that are explicitly for boomers and older people, you know, we're talking around health-related things, financial-related things. But there are also startups like Breezy, which has, you know, provided a skin to an Android tablet that just makes it incredibly intuitive and easy to use. And the interesting there is, although they targeted older people initially, what they've created is a product that's easier to use for everybody.
Yeah, I was just going to say I would like that.
Yeah, right.
And AARP is trying to encourage some of this with your own incubator, right? Tell me about the Hatchery.
So the Hatchery is a physical space for innovation to bring people inside to go through an incubation or an accelerator curriculum that benefits from us also having access to the consumer, AARP members, who can provide real-time market feedback about what it is they're creating, but also to benefit from the subject matter expertise that we at AARP have about the space, about the unmet needs, and about the landscape of what's already in the market.
Well, because I imagine you don't think of the typical sort of startup CEO as being super plugged into the needs of baby boomers. What are the, maybe this is my Bay Area bias talking, but what are the challenges in addressing these consumers?
So the first part of your question, the assumption I would push back at, every family is connected to this issue, either through grandparents, parents. Intergenerationally, people are having challenges and experiences and looking for ways that technology and products and services can make those challenges easier. So, for example, the CEO of CareLinx had a horrible family experience just trying to find a caregiver. And the classic entrepreneur stepped up by saying, nobody should have this terrible experience like we had. I am going to fix this problem.
That's Jody Holtzman, Senior Vice President of Market Innovation at AARP. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming this fall, the first offshore wind farm in the United States. It'll be up and running in early November off the coast of Rhode Island. Now, giant spinning wind-powered turbines can be a controversial proposal on or off land. But this one found a way forward. John Kalish reports.
Last September, a pile driver pounded a 16-ton steel base into the ocean floor. A Rhode Island company, Deepwater Wind, is behind this nearly $300 million project. The five turbines were recently finished after more than a year of construction.
The first offshore wind farm in the United States will be ready to start spinning its blades. And that's a momentous occasion, believe me.
That's Jeffrey Grabowski, Deepwater's CEO. Those wind turbine blades are huge, really huge.
For the five turbines, each blade is 241 feet long and weighs about 29 tons. These are the largest wind turbine blades in North America. You get the idea that this is a really big, complicated construction project.
Those big blades enable the turbines to produce twice the amount of electricity as earlier models, and these turbines are 15 miles from the Rhode Island mainland, which means they haven't aroused the kind of controversy onshore projects have in the past. Clint Plummer is Deepwater's VP for Development.
Our approach has been to focus on identifying areas and technologies that will allow us to avoid the controversy entirely by locating the wind turbines over the horizon so that the people who don't like the way they look don't have to look at them.
Although people on the mainland won't see them, residents of Block Island will because the turbines are just 3 miles offshore. But they do get something in return, the elimination of noisy, polluting generators, which burn 1 million gallons of diesel a year. The wind power will cost about the same as the diesel-generated electricity. Still, that's nearly triple the rate mainland customers pay. And that price will rise every year for 20 years. About 22 miles to the southwest are the Hamptons on the east end of Long Island. Deepwater wants to build its next wind farm with scores of turbines 30 miles offshore from these upscale beach communities. That's meant there's been little opposition from the well-heeled locals. Larry Cantwell is East Hampton Town Supervisor.
Truthfully, if a wind farm of this size was being proposed off the shore of East Hampton or Montauk, and it was visible and it was 10 miles away, I might feel differently about it.
But there is another constituency which isn't so keen on these offshore wind farms, commercial fishermen. In this part of the Atlantic, they catch squid and cod, and there's a scallops fishery which alone generates $500 million a year. They're worried that their livelihood will suffer. And in fact, in Rhode Island, commercial fishing was disrupted during construction, and one operation had to be relocated. But Carl Grossman, a reporter who covered the decades-long battle over nuclear power on Long Island, says other than fishermen, residents there seem to be embracing this new form of renewable power.
This is energy we can live with. I think we're seeing an energy revolution in the making. I'm a sailor, and the winds off Long Island are virtually always blowing.
The wind apparently is also blowing up and down the East Coast. The feds have granted leases for 11 offshore wind farms from Massachusetts to Virginia. A 12th was recently proposed off the coast of North Carolina. In New York, I'm John Kalish for Marketplace.
Rhode Island Public Radio helped us with that report. This final note before we go, good news for cute animals and the people who love them. Giant pandas are no longer endangered. The International Union for Conservation of Nature has moved giant pandas off of the endangered list and onto the vulnerable list. That's great news. The group says we should now turn our attention to the eastern gorilla, which is almost extinct. Now I went and buzzkilled it, didn't I? And that's it. We got to go. The Dow added a 0.25%, 46 points today. The NASDAQ, a new record, advancing 0.5%. The S&P 500 up 0.3%, 6 points. Tommy Andres, Raghu Manavalan, and Vanessa Smith are producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kurwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I am Molly Wood, and we'll see you back here tomorrow, everyone. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.